Okay, so Beck and I spent a while this morning reading feedback memos. And it was, as usual, a very interesting experience. Beck's going to lead off with the major item that appeared amongst the consensus feelings expressed. And then I've got a little follow-up, and then we're going to get into some podcasts and into talking with Dean about video and video distribution.
Okay, so one of the themes that ran throughout the feedback memos yesterday, and for those of you watching on the video, this is really intended for the people in the law school audience, though. Maybe you'll find it interesting. This does not affect the Extension School final project assignment. One of the things that was in these feedback memos was a desire for more clearly written out assignments that were clear in terms of what was expected, what the due dates were, and had some sort of a presence other than just us telling you what they were here in class. And the one assignment that remains in the course is the final project, which many of you expressed some nervousness about. So we wanted to start by letting you guys know, first of all, that you've already completed a huge amount, more than half of the work for this course. This final project, you can think of it as being sort of around 25% of your grade, where the rest of it comes in the scratch project that you've already done, the week's pages that you guys have already been doing, the podcast that you've already done, your presentations, that, you know, and things that your participation in the class, all this work that you guys have put in so far is important to your grade and makes up a large part. Now, my father clearly said to you that he did not want to give you a grade breakdown, and I'm not trying to say, oh yeah, here's the breakdown, it's 75%, 25%. It's more of a flexible thing than that. What he's really going for is a demonstration of your engagement in the class. So as he would put it, if you've been dogging it so far, if you have not been doing a good job on the stuff this far, don't worry, you could still do a great job on the project and have that count for a lot more than 25% of your grade. But for those of you who have been working all along and doing all these assignments and really putting energy into them, there's no need to stress out that this final project is going to take up your whole grade for the class. It does not and it will not take up your whole grade for the class. But that said, here it is. We've put it up in writing on the website. If you go to the main website and click on law, you will find that the thing there is the statement of your final project assignment. And it has four parts to it, two small parts and two big parts. The small parts are because we want to take your assignments and put them together in a website that we're going to create that tries to put them together in a way that makes it fun and interesting for people from the outside who are interested in this class to come and find interesting projects and learn about them and read about them. So what we want for you from the small parts are a 100 by 100 pixel image that could be a picture of you, a logo, anything that you want to visually represent your project in just 100 by 100 pixels, and a short description. And then the big and serious parts of your final project assignment are, number one, what we've been saying all along, we want you to express your project in a cyber medium of your choice. And there's more detail about that on the website. But the basic idea is that we want you to pick one of the cyber media that we have looked at in this course and really put yourself into making the best expression of your project that you can. And the important thing about that is that it needs to be self-contained in the sense that it should be possible for us to direct people to your project from this website that we put together. So if you decide you're going to do a series of podcasts because you think that's the best way to represent your project, we don't just want a bunch of podcasts that you put in our class blog. We want you to make your own podcast series with some page that represents it and tells people what that series is about and gives people a way to subscribe to your individual project podcast. Or similarly, if you make something like a video, you probably also want some kind of a web page that helps you contextualize it. The second big part of the project assignment is that we want you to write an essay, a short essay, 1,000 to 1,200 words, that describes what you've done with your project and gives your reflections on the experience of the project and the course, basically what you've learned in this project. And Then down below this on the page, there's some questions that I thought that people might have with some answers. But if you guys have questions that you want to ask that are popping into your mind right now, you can ask them now. Or if you come up with questions later, you can email them, and I'll answer them and put the answers up on this web page. So this will sort of be our repository for Q&A and basic description of the project. Does anybody have any questions at this point?
I want to say a few things more, too. Go with questions, please.
I just have a brief question. Can we use a combination of the media? Like if we have a podcast we want to use, but then want to create a little video to also post on the same site? Or, you know, can we aggregate the different media?
That's just exactly what I wanted to say. I've been listening to your podcast. I still have a long way to go, but I'm totally engaged, and there's stuff to work with. It's really fun. And the idea of a final project that takes where you are and takes it one step further, at least, that's what I'm interested in. Now, it could be that you take your podcast and you do something with it. You know, you work with it so that it becomes the base, and maybe you join it with text or you join it with some video, and it becomes the product. That's fine. At the same time, I don't want necessarily to tie you to podcast if that isn't the thing that you're most comfortable with. But basically what I'm looking for is I can see that we've already learned quite a remarkable amount just doing what we're doing. I want the final project to involve learning something else in addition, add something else into the mix. And then I'm very hopeful that Becca and I can figure out an architecture for aggregation that will work for us. I also want to just say a word about the 1,000 to 1,200 word Finnish essay. My thought is that that's to be done after your project is complete. So the project due date is the 7th. There's another week for a final thing. And what I'm looking for is not necessarily just focus on the project. It's really the whole enterprise. It's like what you did and what you learned and what your reflection is on the enterprise. Whatever part of it is the thing that just made the impact with you. If hopefully there was some. So that's my thought on that.
So just a couple more little things to add. If you're feeling unsure about what you've chosen to do, you can feel free to come to office hours or to email us, and we'll be happy to talk to you about it and whether it's an appropriate or feasible idea and all of that. We haven't gone over in class how to make or edit web pages. And it's not something that's currently on our full class schedule, but what I am going to do is schedule office hours that I'll hold to work with people, because I think that that will be the most useful way to help people set up the web pages that you specifically want for your projects. So I'll be sort of announcing those as we go along. But the first ones will be next week on Wednesday from 2 to 4 p.m. And if you want to meet with me some other time, you can just email me to schedule whatever you want to schedule. And then the final thing I wanted to say is about which is sort of related to this, is that I think some of you sort of had a reaction to this aggregation and sort of evaluating other people's podcasts as one of these new out-of-the-blue assignments that is showing up in this class. And we actually have a little bit of – so I would have been in favor of continuing pushing forward with this new out-of-the-blue assignment, except that we have a little bit of a technical limitation that we haven't really got the ability to let people do a kind of a rating system on our blog. So I think what we'd like to do is try to encourage you, by showing you some of the really awesome podcasts that people have produced, to go and spend some time reading and also listening and encourage you to post comments. But we're not actually going to make that any kind of an official assignment for you to go and do comments or listening on other people's podcasts.
But on the other hand, if one is thinking about overall what you do and have done in connection with the class, taking the initiative to comment on some other's blogs or posts would be totally wonderful. And I just would reiterate the the essence of what I look for in critique. It's like it's not a grade. The idea isn't to grade. It's to say what you think was the strong point and what you think could be improved. And that tends to make critique of other people's creative work a little easier to take. That's a fine segue to the second topic I wanted to raise here today before we get to Dean. Again, out of the feedback memos, it's clear that you all had strong and, for the most part, extremely positive reactions to Deborah Scranton. And very often we fall into the flaw, I think, rhetorically speaking, of not talking about the most interesting thing that happens in a class. Now, so, for example, the class before, I think the most interesting thing that happened was probably my bad behavior in relationship to Mary, for which I apologize, Mary. But somehow we don't talk about it because this is the sort of thing we don't talk about. And yesterday, the fact that Deborah was such a potent character in many ways, I thought it would be worth it to just spend a minute or two on it. And particularly to get the reactions of Kara and Anne.
Allison,
excuse me. I don't know why I have that wrong. Allison. And Rebecca, who had lunch with Deborah before coming here, and who may, I don't know, may have a different impression than some of you got. So I just was... Tell us what happened at lunch. Tell the class. Give a sense of the lunch, Kara.
So we met and went over to lunch at the Science Center. And it was Professor Nesson, Rebecca, Allison, Deborah, and I. And we just got a little bit into the discussion. We tried not to take away too much from the questions that we thought people would be asking in class, but we tried to ask her sort of her inspiration for the project that she did and sort of where she was now with everything she was doing, what her future, you know, some of the questions that you guys asked here were some of the questions we asked at lunch as well. But she's definitely very passionate about what she does. I think that came through, and she protects certain points of view, I think. So I think we definitely got a sense of that at lunch as well. I don't know if anybody else wants to comment on that, but she, I mean, instead of, a lot of the time she'll answer questions by saying that that's not the kind of question that's geared towards her project or something along those lines, much like the political question or questions about what happens next, which is one of the questions I asked her that she sort of responded to in a different way than what one would expect, I think. And if anybody wants to comment, since I was asking the question directly, I don't know if I'm the best person to comment on her reaction to it. But
did you want to add anything, Allison?
Beck,
you have some comments?
How about you, Beck?
How about you ask me a more specific question?
When we were reading through the feedback memos this morning, numbers of people reacted to Deborah as honest. Did you have that sense of her?
I guess it, yes and no. I found sort of a similar thing to what Kara found, that she had a very guarded and even defensive tactic that she, or sort of tact that she would take in responding to questions. So insofar as honesty is similar to being open, that wasn't really there at all with her. And in fact, in our lunch beforehand, she presented as even much more defensive than how she was in class, which you noted might be because on the way over to lunch, you had raised the idea that the strategy that the U.S. is using in the war in Iraq is a failing strategy because our enemies are greater in number and more intense than they had been, and that that may have given her the impression of us as among the large group of people that it seems like she considers to be people with no actual knowledge of what's happening in the war, who just have a lot of opinions that it should be over, which is, if you happen to vote today in the state of Massachusetts, you'd notice that there was a question on our ballots about this particular issue. You know, are we in favor of total pullout right away and things like that? It maybe is a position that she expects to find in Massachusetts all the time. Anyway, I found her to be passionate. She wasn't, but just not giving a straight answer a lot of the time and seeming to do that in a way that was defensive.
Did you all feel that she was empathic? Well, here, now, I don't mean to constrain it.
Yes, please, just open it up.
I very much had the same impression that she seemed defensive about her work, and I think that something this sort of ties into, it's not really the same idea, but an analogous situation is in copyright, there's this issue that people's creations of work are sort of like their children. I think Gary Larson, we went through this example in one of my classes about Gary Larson posting this comment in a newspaper about how his creations were his work and they were his children and he wanted to distribute them the way he wanted to. And I sort of got that impression from her, too. She viewed her work as almost an extension of herself, and what she wanted to reveal about it is what she chose to reveal about it. And she was defensive about certain parts, like she doesn't want to reveal all aspects of what went into her work or what went into her creation of this piece. And I guess it's sort of that same, an analogous situation with the creation of a child. I mean, it's the same thing, I felt.
Well, I disagree. I didn't find her defensive. I just think that when you produce something, you want people to see your work without tainting it with your personal opinions. Because if she says, well, I am for the war in Iraq or I'm against it, then we'll all see the movie through that lens. Instead, if we just see the movie out there, you know, I think she didn't want to taint it. And I also appreciated the fact that she felt she had the right to speak about some things and not to speak about others. I think usually what people do is that you ask a question, and if they don't want to answer it, they just kind of evade it. But, you know, they say something politically correct and just move on. And so I kind of liked it that she said, I don't want to comment on that. I think that's a right people should have, you know? Like, you have the right to ask any question, and they have the right to answer them or not. I mean, she's not like a public official or anything.
Spoken like a journalist. I mean, I agree with that, but then I thought it was very interesting is that she made a comment sort of dancing around the issue of sort of perspective and whether or not you really can completely detach yourself or something. And she essentially admitted that, you know, you are always going to sort of color anything that you produce. You know, even if you consciously try and not do it, subconsciously you're going to do that. And she essentially admitted to that. But at the same point then, I feel like if you sort of recognize that conscious or subconscious, your opinion is going to have an effect, then, you know, sort of the interest of full disclosure, I think there's something to be said for knowing what your opinion is. I mean, you know, more power to you for trying to repress it and trying to present an unbiased picture. But still, you know, I still, at least as a consumer of media and thought, would still like to know what your opinion is, even if you're trying to be as unbiased as possible. I don't know. Maybe that was just sort of my reaction.
Well, I just want to add that she didn't just admit it. She owned it. She said, I don't believe in objectivity. So she's, you know.
I interpreted what I think some of us are interpreting as hostility as her just sort of walking into an environment that was different than probably the one she usually shows her movie in. I thought that we were sitting here in the context of this idea of empathic argument, and that's what we were thinking about when we came to class, at least. She probably usually shows this movie to people who are thinking about Iraq or thinking their brain is in a totally different place. So when we immediately start asking her questions about argument and her perspective, I imagine that's probably a hot button issue for her that is not usually the first question she gets when she shows that movie. I bet she usually gets, I don't know, reactions about Iraq or about her experience with these soldiers or people's reactions to the war. And it was, I imagine, just a very different, that I interpreted her hostility as just like kind of a surprise at why we were so targeted on this issue that she was probably very self-conscious about already.
I agree that she should have the right to refuse to answer questions. And I don't think that she really, I don't think that she did anything wrong in that. I don't think she did anything wrong altogether. But I mean, I don't think she was evasive in that respect. But I'm not so sure that I agree that she owned up to the sort of inevitability of coloring her portrayal with subjectivity. I feel like she did try and take a stand that she was telling the soldiers' stories and not her own. And the idea that there's no way of avoiding that, I felt like she was trying to convey the idea that she had avoided that and was almost a conduit for the views of these soldiers. And so I felt that was where she sort of was a little bit evasive, because the idea that, I think maybe she thought that we were accusing her of deliberately injecting her own views into it, whereas I think we were just trying to point out that there's really, despite the best intentions, some of it's going to creep in. But I felt that was maybe where we were sort of at loggerheads here.
I mean, just to build on that, I think she made a real conscious point of trying to present herself as the voice of the soldiers and sort of set herself up as, look, I really know these people. I'm an expert in what they think. I'm from where they're from. You know, and you guys are a bunch of Harvard law students. I mean, she used a lot of military jargon. She used a lot, you know, she did the lock and loading and a bunch of other terms that I didn't understand because I'm not an expert in the military. And I think that was very intentional. I think it was designed to sort of set herself up as an expert in an area that we were not. So I would say, in response to your comment, I don't think she was surprised. I mean, I think she's a smart lady. She's a sophisticated woman. She knew coming in, you know, this is a bunch of Harvard law students, and I'm going to approach them differently. And the way that I need to gain credibility with them is going to be different than the way I would gain credibility with a different audience. To me, that's what I saw her doing. And it made her, when she got sort of, I did interpret it as defensive, and when she refused to acknowledge any kind of internal leanings that may have affected the movie, to me, that kind of undercut a lot of her other credibility, which is too bad, because I thought the film looked great.
Just two points that pick up on what you said and what you said, which is I think the defensiveness I felt from her was partly her trying to be a little bit ambiguous about things, which was actually the strength of her argument and the strength of the film in the first place. Like she was playing, she was not answering questions directly because there's a space where that she's created that's totally ambiguous, and that's its power. That's how she convinces, you know, sort of Manhattan film goers and also the military to be involved in this project. And then I think that the defensiveness, that there was some real defensiveness, and partly I think it's because Harvard Law School is an offensive environment. It's a hostile environment. I don't think that I'd want to come speak to a class of students whose first reaction is not, thanks for coming, this is a really great thing, but it's actually, I see an inconsistency in your argument. And it's like, I'm just trying to make a film, you know? It's like, I kind of empathize with what she was trying to do and think there's a lot of power in making just telling a story and letting whatever arguments come out of it exist instead of saying, here's who I am, here are my views, and now I'm going to present you with an argument. Everyone goes to sleep. That's earnest, and that's what we're taught our first year of law school, but I don't think it's effective arguing.
I think I was wondering when she was being kind of cagey about her personal beliefs. I was wondering if she was doing it just kind of like Andrew was saying, to get both sides of the spectrum to watch the film. If you knew that she was an anti-war activist, then, you know, half of the country's just not even going to bother. And, you know, maybe that was just for distribution. You know, she was talking about how she needs to make money off of it. But I was wondering about the implications of that strategic choice on her part for us to make empathic arguments. Because when we were talking in class, I don't know, I guess last week, you were suggesting that the first thing you have to do in at least in making your argument, is say who you are, own your position, and then convince people from that position. So they know who you are. They know, I think it was when Joel was speaking, you said, are you, you know, the rich, bougie, you know, Martha's Vineyard guy, or are you, you know, something else? And she consciously chose not to do that. And I wonder if that's something we should think about in terms of which way we want to go for our particular arguments.
So sort of following off that point, I also think that a lot of our comments, and I was approaching it the same way everybody else in the class was. I think I experienced some frustration with some of the things she chose not to say, and I felt like I sensed inconsistencies. But all of the comments that we approached her with, I don't really think that most people, and it wouldn't have been my reaction either, so I don't really want to be that critical of it, but I don't think we prefaced it with, wow, what a fantastic movie. And my brother was sitting in on the class. He's a filmmaker in New York, a documentary filmmaker, and he went to film school, and he just said that, like, in that environment, the automatic first thing you say is, wow, I just really applaud your filmmaking. What amazing! You say film 6 times and something positive 6 times, and then you can talk. So I think that might be like a background difference that we wouldn't have, you know, thought of, but that she might have felt, even if she was prepared for Harvard Law students to be adversarial.
I think I'd like to continue with the points that Mary and other people had made. I'm not sure that she was probably prepared to present on anything other than the war tapes, like in the nature in which we want her to discuss. And I also think that maybe we should have prepared her a little bit better for our overall themes of the course, because I think we could have drawn out more about how she empathized with the soldiers. I also thought that maybe we could have gotten her to discuss larger themes if we hadn't approached it more or quite as critically. Like, I do think we kind of jumped in and started asking her about the war tapes, and maybe we should have tried to explain more of our themes and draw out the empathetic arguments instead of just grilling her.
Can I ask you a question about that? I'm on Dean's mic.
Oh, good.
Although, well, Rebecca, I don't know if I'm going to answer your question, but I found it hard to try and phrase a question that I thought she would be responsive to.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask about, because I was really excited for her to come, and I'm really excited still to see this movie. I was expecting not to be feeling very critical of her when she arrived, and it seemed to me that from the moment she walked into my father's office, she was already in the defensive pose. I don't know exactly how that happened, but I was having this hard time figuring out. I thought that Kara asked her an extremely thoughtful question, which was basically about this empathy at lunch. She basically said, I can see that you really are, this project is really about empathizing with the soldiers. Is there a next step that comes after that? Like, once you empathize, do you then want to persuade them to a position? Which makes a lot of sense from where we were all coming from. And she completely parried the question, and that was where I sort of got to what you're saying. I'm not sure exactly how I would have asked a question like that.
But I'm not sure if we were properly prepared necessarily. Like, maybe we all should have seen the war tapes before so that she could have, like, we saw the trailer, but, and I'm not sure it would be feasible to have seen it, but so that we could appreciate her true work, and then maybe she could have asked us instead, well, what do you think my perspective is? You know, what do you think my political views are after we saw it? And, you know, like, why do you think that way? Or something like that. Like, maybe we didn't have enough basis to try and communicate with her. But I definitely concur with what you said.
I mean, I think part of the issue in the context that we're talking in right now is again, how we were approaching things, which is not just the empathizing part, which I think she really wanted to create as much of a tabula rasa as she could in terms of being able to bring forth just what these soldiers had to say in terms of their camera work and everything. But I think one of the main issues, one of the problems she had with my question, it wasn't just, I wasn't just asking her if she wanted to convince the soldiers. I was just saying, once you've done this, you know, once you are this conduit or however you want to call it, is there a next step? Like, did you ever envision somewhere down the line something else that you would do with the product of whatever happens when you're done with the movie? And she definitely just had an objection to viewing this as a step towards anything else. So she just wanted to see this film as the goal. She wanted to leave people unsettled with no resolution, really, except the resolution that each person sort of comes up with individually. That's what I got from her trying to avoid the question completely. So.
Yeah, let me just say a word about that. Actually, repeating Rebecca, but one of the things that struck me in our conversation about this, Rebecca, was your observation that sometimes artists speak best if they just let their work speak for them. And I thought her work was amazing. I was just really stunned by it. And the use of humor in it, and the fact that she's telling three stories, but in fact, you're really just seeing the soldiers' stories. It's different soldiers, but you're basically feeling immersed in this environment. Quite extraordinary. I realized in asking myself the question, where is her empathy? I went back to the waterboarding and was thinking, well, for whom do we empathize in the waterboard video? And I realized I found myself empathizing with the torturers, because I realized the people who were doing the waterboarding were these soldiers, just different versions of these soldiers. And the brutalizing environment that produces young killers and young torturers is powerfully represented in her work. And so, I don't know, I had quite a different reaction from Becca's, at least. I kind of had this sense of well, Becca asked very interesting questions. Why did she tell us that she was on the U.S. ski team? And what was her purpose in saying, do you know a soldier? Do you know a soldier?
Well, because she said she wanted to tell the story from the inside out. So that's the whole point. I mean, if we don't know as soldiers, then that's a way of seeing the war from the inside out, not from the outside in.
Well, interesting questions. Thank you for a very interesting discussion on this. I want to pass on, but I feel like I like the idea that we talk about the things we've seen. I think we should make it a more regular practice. All right, now we move on to Dean. Dean, here, put this back up.
Select the microphone.
Say it again.
All right,
yep. Little break.
Okay, so just for fun, while we're waiting for the tape change, I'll start this. You guys are ready to go whenever. Okay, so these are the Jorge brothers.
I can't hear you.
These are the Jorge brothers. They are from Salta, Argentina, which is where the green arrow is here. And they've had, I think about views, 1.5 million views, if you can see down here. So two, I don't know what they are, 8 to 10-year-old brothers from Argentina have like millions of people from all over the place watching them. And they weren't found by a talent scout. They were just uploaded their video to YouTube, and here they are in front of Harvard Law students, which is kind of cool. And so I guess the direction I'm going is totally away from the empathic argument, and I'm going towards the strategy of, well, how do you make video that people want to see, and how do you get it out there? It kind of goes back to the networks, the small world networks talk. And the main thing that I wanted to discuss today is Lonely Girl 15. How many people are familiar with YouTube's Lonely Girl 15? So most of the class, like 70%. So this is Lonely Girl 15.
So you're really funny, and
So she just mentioned one of the top 30 most subscribed to YouTubers, which is paid to the order of...
Hi guys.
Oops.
So this is the first video blog. This is
so this is paid to the order of... this person is an actual person. The girl before is known as Bree, a 16-year-old girl who starts video blogging about her situation. She's got really strict religious parents. She's homeschooled. She's sheltered. But she's also kind of intellectual and smart and, you know, interesting to watch and cute, I think, or I'm sure a lot of people think. But anyways, so... And she's really 19, so... But so she mentioned this YouTuber, which is kind of, I think, one of the ways, I mean, this is definitely one of the ways that she sort of became, that she rose up to fame. So let me go over the story, I guess, first. So... She put up a promo video on May 24th of this year, 2006, which was just a video that kind of referenced this pay to the order of, and I'll show that. It's really short. Well, maybe I won't show it. So she created a video and referenced this this really popular YouTuber and sort of got her foot into the door. People started watching her videos because I assumed that there was some commenting action and people said, oh, you know, in the comments people were able to go back to this Bree girl, Lonely Girl 15's videos. And so in doing so, she kind of got herself... established as someone in the YouTube community and quickly became very popular, watched by hundreds of thousands of people. And then at some point, people started wondering, wait, this is really well produced. This is supposedly a 16-year-old girl who lives in a sheltered, you know, place. And people started wondering, is this really real? And it became kind of an unfolding drama. Well... Compared to a lot of the video blogs up there, the lighting is done really well. It's shot on a quick cam, which is just a regular webcam, like a $30 webcam. But it's cut concisely. I'll let you watch a little bit more, just so you can see the quality of it. And so they do some stuff that's kind of purposely low quality looking like this to sort of throw people a bit. But
my dad. Yes, he did ask me something.
The stuff that looks like that in my videos is just to throw people off.
I know. This is the worst one. The reason I had this one was because right here, about halfway through the video... About halfway through the video, here we go. So this picture right here that you can see part of, people figure that's a well-known portrait of Aleister Crowley, who is an occult figure, which that's one of the big things that people found that was like, wait a second, why does this 16-year-old girl have a shrine to Aleister Crowley in her room? and so...
19-year-old.
So her first blog post was on June 16th. The promo video that I actually should show because it's very short.
I'm thinking of, I try calling it here.
Okay. So this is the video that, this is the equivalent of our little, like, 3-minute trailer. This is the thing that she very first, that her team very first put up. And this is referencing Pay to the Order of, which is the other video blogger. So that was their little kind of trailer that they put out there. That was what they put their feelers out and sort of created sort of a tribute to this girl so this girl could say, hey, here's someone who's interested in what I'm doing. This Pay to the Order of says, here's someone who's interested in what I'm doing, so I'm going to shoot links back out to her. And so there was a little bit of interaction there. And so then she puts up her first blog post, which was the first thing I showed you guys. Then 15 posts later, you see the Aleister Crowley on August 6th. And then, so that was when there was a ton of discussion. Is this some kind of, like, is this a bunch of movie execs trying to get us primed for some kind of Blair Witch Project? What is this? Some people were saying, no, she's totally legit. Other people are saying, no, this is, like, the biggest marketing scam in the world.
Where did the discussion happen?
What's that?
Where did the discussion
this
happen?
This is all happening on the comments. At first, there's discussion down here on the comments, but then people start blogging about it. It starts getting, I mean, this is, she's getting hundreds of thousands of views and has, like, Wikipedia, there was kind of a fight on Wikipedia, is Lonely Girl 15 an actual phenomenon worthy of being on Wikipedia? And, like, they had to have a vote on it, and they unanimously decided that, yes, it was something that could be a Wikipedia article when it was voted on.
Didn't they take it down at some point for it and then put it back up?
They took it down and then voted on it because people got upset. And so, let's see. So there were blog posts and articles like this. This is a alternate reality gaming website, and they were talking about, you know, speculating, is this an alternate reality game, something, you know, some kind of weird crossover game that they're going to start up. And so this is going on in the blogosphere, but there was no, like, Lonely Girl herself wasn't ever getting directly involved. This was all people who had watched the videos and were starting their own conversations about it. She just started putting up videos and kept it fairly simple. Like, it was just a series of blog posts, and she'd kind of say, I like you guys, but it was never very specific about starting conversations with people. She didn't really start conversations with people. And so, on September 8th, the son of a well-known tech blogger dug up some info. He found Bree, the character's actual MySpace page, which was locked. It was someone named Jessica Rose. So he found a MySpace page and found the Google cache of it, which had pictures of Bree, Lonely Girl 15, kind of, and sort of blew the top off of this whole thing. Within 5 days, there was a New York Times article. And this is Jessica Rose, I think, smoking, maybe? I don't know. But not being 16-year-old Brie. So in, like, 4 months, it went from a little promo video and then just a series of simple, you know, well-cut and well-lit, but really simple videos that eventually start getting viewed by millions of people and have the New York Times writing articles about it. And I guess I just wanted to talk about how that could be or why that might be. What were the key factors? What was the magic that went into this?
Well, you know, looking between this and the picture of the Argentinian rock band, mm-hmm. You know, it seems to me the things that create buzz in cyber media are like the same things that you know, create buzz and get people's attention in every other single form of media, you know, cute kids and pretty girls, and the fact that it's a new type of media and it's, you know, people finding out things through MySpace, you know, through the kind of like the cyber gloss on it, it's still basically, I don't know, just from what we've seen so far, pretty similar to like TV advertising, posters, anything else really.
Cute kids and pretty girls and cats that flush toilets and
explosions.
Yeah, right.
That's it. I was going to say the same thing. My first reaction was that it was just, you know, it's a pretty girl, so people are going to start watching it, as opposed to if it were some, you know, guy sitting there confessing his heart out to a webcam. But then I remembered that actually months, probably about a year ago, maybe 8 months before Lonely Girl came out, there was this YouTube phenomenon called Emo Kid or something. And it was this, like, wannabe 16-year-old boy who was really dark and really emo. If you guys don't know what that means, it just means he had jet black hair over one eye and cried about girls all the time. And he was really popular too. But that also was sort of, he was some kid in England who just thought that emo kids in America were hilarious, so he wanted to make fun of them. And that, I guess, is another point in that you can make something completely over the top and sort of satirical in this medium, and it can get a lot of play too. And I think that's what people found interesting about that, beyond maybe just a pretty girl or kids are really entertaining. If you can, it is sort of the same niche. I mean, he was being satirical in the same way Borat is, and people found it funny.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why.
Because it was taboo and you felt like you shouldn't be watching it, or you're basically seeing something you wouldn't ordinarily see in everyday life. And so it's kind of intriguing because of that.
I was talking with kind of back to the pretty girls and little boys in rock bands thing. I was talking with Gene Koo, and he brought up the idea that it's, yes, there is that. I mean, you have to have a good product or something that people are intrigued by, be it explosions or whatever. But there's also almost like a middle school politics to it. Like, them putting up the video saying, hey, you know, a shout out to this this pay to the order of is sort of like, you know, like doing something nice. You know, you're the new kid at school and you do something nice for the really popular girl. And then if it takes, you're in. Like, you've got an in there. And so there's sort of, I don't know, there's that aspect of it too, as well as the cute, taboo young girl.
So maybe just to debunk both of those theories, concurrent with the latter stages of Lonely Girl 15 was the rise of Geriatric 1927 on YouTube, who was a late stage pensioner in England who started blogging about his life, basically. And in a series of segments, went from basically his what he remembered in his early days up through the World War II and to where he's at now. And even while these other, like the Lonely Girl 15 phenomenon was occurring, Geriatric passed her and I think became, and still probably is, the number one subscribed YouTube individual out there. And he's neither cute nor girl.
You could argue he's kind of cute. I mean,
well, but he also didn't start off his. I mean, he responded to, I guess, Renato. So you maybe could say that he is engaging in some of this middle school politics. But I don't think that was his intent to get thrust into the scene, because he seemed rather overwhelmed by the response he received on YouTube.
There is an explosion in this one, actually. But that's a great example. Thank you.
I know that this Lonely Girl 15 article, towards the end, it asks the question of was this ethical? And I think that's a question that we've talked about a lot in this class. When you have someone faking or putting up like fake news or fake whatever, fake blogs, And I don't see anything wrong with Lonely Girl 15 and what she did. I think, I mean, someone could argue that you're deceiving little pimply teenagers who relate to her, and that if there's an old dirty man behind this girl, like writing a script and kind of molding the minds of these pimply teenagers who relate to her, then that's not fair. But I just don't see anything wrong with it. It's a form of entertainment. It's a form of fun. And I think pimply teenagers will be affected by a lot of things that we don't want them to be affected by. And what's wrong with a fake blog? I mean, are blogs supposed to be real? Are art, are, is news supposed to be real? Like, what? I think that we have to take some responsibility for what forms our opinions.
So I have to come clean about something related to that on both of our behalfs. Just in the middle of the summer, my father and I were both oblivious about Lonely Girl 15. We had no idea, and Jonathan Zittrain came over to our house with a friend. They were really into Lonely Girl 15. So they took out this computer, and we downloaded it, and my dad and my mom and I looked at Lonely Girl 15, and we watched the first episode of this. And like about a minute into it, I was like, do we really have to watch this? I'm dying. This is so boring and horrible. And we watched the whole first episode. And then Jonathan said, well, what's interesting is these people are not sure whether it's real or not. And as the whole story unfolded, I got interested in that aspect of it. And then I went and looked at them. Like, the fact that there was this mystery about the thing was a whole other, having nothing to do with the cute girl aspect of it, element of interest, where if you see it as just as something that's trying to be entertaining, it's trying to get viewers, if you could make it a mystery like that, then maybe it's not about ethics, it's about entertainment. It's no different than Lost or some other, you know, television show that you watch where you don't really know what's going on.
Christina. I just wanted to say with the explosions thing, like, yeah, I mean, YouTube top videos are consistently like animals falling off of skateboards and stuff, but there's also kind of like, there's been a few incidences where people have kind of used that to convey an important message. Like, I remember when the net neutrality issue came up. Like, one of the most popular videos on YouTube about net neutrality was Ask a Ninja, he's this guy who dresses up in a ninja costume and, like, answers people's questions, usually about ninjas.
Oops. Didn't mean to talk over you with the video.
No,
but
no, it's fine. That was my whole point.
All right, should we show it? I was planning on showing this anyways. So this
is how he solves the problem of having to lip sync all the video.
So this is Wayne's World. This is two guys in California in their basement with a blue screen. Like, this is the Wayne's World that gets on the internet and gets huge and actually then has something to say. Like, FCC lawyers said that the net neutrality video that they made was it was like the best explanation of the issue anywhere. And that's the FCC's lawyer saying that. So, yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Like, Ethan Zuckerman, who is part of Global Voices, which Rebecca McKinnon came and talked about, he wrote a blog post about one of the two guys from Ask a Ninja, Kent Nichols, came and talked at at PopTech, which is a kind of a conference. And he was saying they just ran across, or they talked about some of their stats, that they've got 20 million views in the last 10 months, et cetera, et cetera. It's big. And so, like, I guess that's the next thing is, like, it doesn't have to be explosions or it can be anything. There are so many different directions to take it. I guess that was just another illustration of people doing something that seems totally goofy and inane, but really reaching a lot of people on an important issue like network neutrality.
So just so that we know where we're going, would be a very good segue to listening to a few podcasts, but I don't want to shut the discussion off prematurely.
On the Lonely Girl 15 controversy, it seems to reflect this constant tension that we go back and forth on, just depending on the context, this tension about identity in the cyber world. Because when we see something like Lonely Girl, we say, well, we have a really healthy idea of what identity in the cyber world really means, and we know that this is entertainment, and there's nothing wrong with people sort of pretending to share things or, you know, with playing with the facts in the news, because we have a healthy distance from reality that we can touch and feel in the cyber world, and we know we have to be skeptical and compare and be more actively engaged. And then at the same time, we get really, really excited about the prospect of really intimate connections over vast differences in these new networks that are forming. And we say it's amazing. People from Ghana can talk to people from Iran, and we can develop these really vibrant social networks that can bring a whole new form of social life into being. And, I mean, I wonder, we keep going back and forth on whether it's really exciting because people can make genuine connections from enormous distances in the cyber world, to going to, well, this is all really kind of fake anyway, so it's a perfectly fine space for people to be fake in. I know where I fall on that side. I'm more on the side of skeptical of everything, but it's just me.
I think that's interesting, though, sort of talking about how everybody's skeptical of everything, and that sort of just made me think about what I thought was the most interesting things that I'd seen on YouTube, sort of were in kind of that vein, is, you know, a lot of it is sort of just this stuff that's fake and funny and whatever, but there's also other things that have come about that have been a lot more serious. And the one that I always think of is the whole whistleblower Coast Guard guy from back last summer. Mm-hmm. I mean, this guy posted I pulled it up here, see how long it was, 10.5-minute video essentially saying, you know, the Coast Guard is spending all this money on these anti-missile protections for Coast Guard boats, and, you know, the whole thing is flawed and nobody will listen to me, and, like, he then used YouTube as a way to try and blow the whistle. And so I just kind of wonder about how much of the noise of, you know, cats flushing toilets and, you know, cute girls, yada, 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 you know, how much that, you know, obviously that helps the medium grow, but how much that might detract from sort of other possible sort of serious uses in there. I see you pulled it right up too. You're doing very good at getting everything there today. So I just kind of wonder to what extent sort of the some of the more serious issues can sort of kind of be lost in the noise of sort of the funny stuff that we all just sort of get a kick out of watching.
Well, I find myself impressed with the way in which you're each dichotomizing things, and it doesn't seem like it's a necessary thing to decide either or. It's quite possible that the funny stuff builds the medium, and it makes it possible for serious stuff to find an audience. And it's not like each piece has to find the same audience. So it's just somehow clearly all evidence of something that's really explosive.
I mean, there's also, it's like The Daily Show, like, sort of they approach things in a really ridiculous way, but they're also bringing issues to light where that's not the only place people who hear about those issues are, they follow up on them elsewhere, too. So it can be, you know, a jump-off point for things.
I just wanted to suggest, as a matter of approach and technique, even The Daily Show, but I think especially like this Ask a Ninja thing, is very, very, very low budget. It's so easy to do this. Like, all they did with, I hope everyone noticed with this ninja, is they just dress this guy up in a ridiculous costume, and he goes in front of a screen and makes stupid cracks for probably about 20 minutes, 15 minutes of which was not funny. So they just cut out the 15 minutes that's not funny, and then they're just left with, you know, the gems, and they cut it together, and you could do it in iMovie.
Also, like, I'm hearing a few different purposes maybe of the network or of open networks, because it depends whether we want it to promote a diverse array of perspectives so that we can find the truth in it, in which case we'd probably tend to be against people who are putting fraudulent or, you know, untrue material up there. But on the other hand, isn't it also a space for people to share their personal identity and to communicate with others, and they're free to put whatever they want? It's also a social networking tool. So somebody had mentioned the social connections between people of different countries. And so I think there are many different purposes that potentially it could facilitate. At the same time, and I think somebody mentioned that perhaps we should have, or should there be limits or control, should information be censored, or is some information not appropriate to put up there or to put out? And if so, who should determine these rules?
Well, that provides a nice point of departure. Obviously, our interest in this discussion and this opening of experience will hopefully relate to your thought about how you might think about your projects. And the idea is kind of to expand the space in which you think and lower down your sense of how much resource you need to actually pull something off. It really has it calls for a spark of genius as much as anything else, or a spark of craziness or something, but some spark. And many different sparks seem to be capable of lighting fires in the space. So, Beck, I was hoping that you would take us into Second Life and show us a little something.
Do we want to try and do...
I don't think so.
Okay. Sure. I'd be happy to.
Do you need this?
Yeah, I will definitely need the audio.
So just while she's getting set, Dean, answer a few basic questions for us.
Yes.
I need to introduce Dean. Dean came into my life as somebody who was willing to help cut video, and he has just become the most valued part of this enterprise. Dean,
what's your connection with the Extension School? I was actually... an undergrad student up till last year when I graduated from the Extension School.
And what was your experience at the Extension School?
Mostly since I was here, I was taking classes on campus at night, but I did take a couple of distance courses. And got to watch them on...
And what's your day job now besides working with us?
I think I mentioned here before, I work with participatory culture on the Democracy Player.
And what's Telemusic?
Telemusic Vision is it's a video feed, actually. It's a video feed of independent music videos. We kind of are just geared towards promoting independent music and independent musicians by showing videos. Primarily through Democracy Player.
So you're more or less into video promotion, thinking about it.
Sure.
Yeah. Good.
One other thing I want to mention before we move on is a lot of people don't know it, but many times you guys can shoot video on your digital camera, or your, you know, if you have got an old one that doesn't work that well, you might find a friend who's got one, but. People, through the Extension School, especially since you guys might not have resources, immediately available. These things are great for doing videos. You can save the video, and then if you have Windows XP, then you automatically can get Windows Movie Maker. And if you have a Macintosh computer, you probably have iMovie. And it's very simple to do video. Like, you just point and shoot, and then upload it to your computer, and then the service I recommend, actually, over Blip TV, or over, pardon, over YouTube, is a service called Blip.tv. The reason I recommend them is because instead of just making the videos available in Flash, they make the videos available in the original format you put them up in, as well as Flash, so that if people want to download the video and then cut it up and use it in another way. Like, someone took one of the class videos, a blog called Ivygate that blogs about Ivy League schools. They took part of the Nick Sylvester class, cut 7 minutes of it out, and then uploaded it onto YouTube into their blog post and started a conversation about it. And I think, actually, Wayne Marshall, Becca's husband, also did some blogging about it. Kind of cool.
All right, now those of you who are online are welcome to go into Second Life and meet Becca there. Are the people in the class who've tried to get to Berkman Island and have had difficulty? Because now is a great opportunity if you happen to be online.
So what kind of a podcast do you want to hear? You just want to hear a few podcasts that extension students
make? Here's what I'd like you to do, Beck. I'd like you to describe for people the experience that you had in Second Life last night and do your best to kind of reproduce it.
Okay. Let me just tell this friend of mine in here that I'm talking to other people. Sorry, that's blocked by this playlist, but I told him that I was hosting the whole law school class and I can't chat. He says, okay, this is a professor at UT who happens to be hanging out on the island right now. So what we did last night, the extension school students are doing their projects in groups rather than as individuals, and they had the same podcast assignment as you guys did. Each of them individually had to make a podcast using empathic argument on the issue that their group is doing a project on. And last night, one of the groups was meeting in Second Life with me in order to listen to the podcast that they had made and talk about empathic argument and the ways in which their podcasts did a good job and the ways in which they could be improved. And so I set up this MP3 player that you can see right here that can play things off of the web. I haven't loaded all of your podcasts into it yet, but it's on my list of things to do. And in a minute, I'll back up from this. Actually, I might as well back up from it right now so you can see where we are here. So I'm in this amphitheater area. And this is where we had this meeting last night with this group. And this is the sort of the main area that you arrive at when you get to Berkman Island. So the MP3 player set up here meant that the group was meeting right there and also that there were other people who just happened to be interested in our course who were on the island who just showed up and participated in this meeting that we had with the group. And we just played the podcasts, which is kind of an exciting experience in Second Life because it's often a pretty silent experience. People talk by typing. You don't hear people's voices very often. So we played the podcasts of a couple of the students, and we just talked about them. That's what we did.
So?
Would you like to hear one?
I would.
What kind of a podcast would you like to hear? I have various different options. I don't know what you'd be most interested in. Like, do you want to hear one that we actually did last night, or do you want to hear one in which a student raps like Eminem as much as he can, or
ooh, yeah,
one in which...
Go with that one.
Okay, so let's see. That's this... The
and
fifth
then the one.
One
that addresses the question of voice anonymity, I thought was elegant.
Okay. I think that this will be this one.
Yeah.
But I can
books,
stop it if you want.
Course materials and assignments, lecture notes, quizzes, tests, everything. They put it all online in an easily readable digital form on a web page, and they make it open to the world. And they've done this for literally hundreds of classes. You can go on their website and just watch an MIT calculus lecture and read the class notes if you want to. And it's a really great thing. What MIT's found is that now most students who go to MIT have actually watched lectures from MIT through OpenCourseWare before they even come. And it cost them a lot of money, obviously. They had to build a server infrastructure, pay professors for the rights to the contents, and produce and edit all of this. But overall, it's been a good thing. And I think the same kind of idea makes a lot of sense for the Harvard Extension School. And when I say that, you might think, oh, is this one of those wide-eyed free software geeks lived in the basement of MIT and wants to get rid of copyright law, hanging out with Richard Stallman and all those guys? But that's not me. I know that professors need choice in how they exercise their copyright because, you know, they need copyright to make their living. But choice can go two ways. If professors want to share their words with the world, the institution should provide the infrastructure for them to do that. Because sharing can help everybody.
Okay, so let me, let's see, I'll play you one of the ones that we listened to last night also before I go on to the one that you requested, if that's okay. This one is interesting in a way that's similar to this last one in that it has a strong element of entertainment, and there's a question of whether that actually obscures the message or helps the message. If it will play for us.
Something relevant, something modern, the internet!
I'm David Wang, an extension student in Cyber One and a member of the project group the Cyber One Warriors. If you know the introduction from the song from Avenue Q, The Internet is for Porn, you probably also know how true it is. Porn and sex are everywhere in the net, and as we've learned, Second Life is no exception. While the terms of service say adult areas are for adults, teen areas just for teens, it is a self-certification that determines who is a child and who is an adult. Without a mechanism to be sure of age, there is no way to be certain. For this reason, our group chose age verification in Second Life as a project. You might think we're a bunch of prudes trying to stifle sexual activities in Second Life. Nothing could be further from the truth.
Normal people don't sit at home and look at porn on the internet.
Oh.
What?
You have no idea.
Like the normal people in the song, we like the fantasy life that Second Life allows. If you own a business in Second Life that caters to adults, whether as an independent operator or as the owner or operator of a bar, a sex hotel, or strip club, you probably think we want to shut you down. Again, that is not our intent. We want to be able to enjoy your services just as much as anyone else that is an adult, that is. We don't want to see your business suffer because of age verification. We want to see it increase. By showing you care enough to be sure your patrons are adults, you will be setting an example in Second Life for others to follow. Patrons can use your services secure in the knowledge that they are not potentially breaking any laws by exploiting a minor. People trying to regulate Second Life will have less ammunition to use against you if you voluntarily comply as well. This would be a positive step in the direction of reducing online exploitation of minors. Just like a system exists in First Life to ensure that adult environments are only filled with adults, we believe a similar system should exist in Second Life. We know what goes on in Second Life is a lot like what goes on in the rest of the internet. We just want to make sure that it is a safe, fun place for adults and children alike. Thank you for considering support of this campaign.
Now I'll just play the one more that was my father's requested one, because it is a beautifully elegant podcast, I think.
Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3. Okay, are we broadcasting? Cool. Good evening. My name is Andy Abrahamson. I'm an avatar. So I'm not only unused to podcasting and public speaking, I'm also not used to speaking. We avatars usually type our thoughts. My fellow avatars, I want to reach out to you this evening. I feel your pain and your frustration. We don't just type our thoughts. We type them at the same time. And when we're typing, we're not listening. And when we're listening, others think that we're IMing. I know I am particularly bad at this. And you just say, your problem is that you want everyone to listen to you. And you're right. You put your avatar heart and avatar soul into a perfectly correctly spelled sentence. And before you can hit return, someone else asks you if you want a margarita. And you have to delete all your careful typing, just so you can say no. And I know you people listening to this in the so-called real world are going to say, this is just an avatar talking. Why can't he get a life? If he wants a conversation, why doesn't he switch off his computer and go talk to someone? And you are so right. But I can't go to Harvard in the real world. And I can only legitimately wear my Harvard t-shirt in Second Life. And I do want to find a way of talking with other avatars so we don't just talk at each other. Or at least find some way of controlling all the other avatars so they all listen to me. People of the real world, you may not take me seriously. I do not take you seriously either. But some believe we are a part of you. And if we are, then our problems are your problems. And if we are all talking at once, then maybe you are too. Good night. And good luck.
So the beauty of this particular podcast is that this group's project is to advocate the addition of voice capabilities into Second Life so that people don't have to type all of the time. And the solution that they're proposing, it seems from this, is that there's the possibility for people who want to remain anonymous. The biggest thing that you have to empathize with on the opposition is people who are worried about the loss of anonymity that comes when your real voice ends up in Second Life. He's trying to empathize with them by offering them this possible solution, which he executes himself, of allowing some kind of a computer-disguised voice instead of your real voice if you don't really want to use your real voice. And he just doesn't actually say it, but it's there. It comes through to somebody who's listening to it. It's amazing how engaging it is to actually listen to him speak. So that's all the ones that I'll show you guys, but I wanted to invite you, first remark to you that it's quite amazing life of the mind that is developing on Berkman Island. There are a lot of people who come just interested in talking about issues and extremely interested in what's going on in our course. And they would love to meet you and talk to you about your projects and your podcasts. So if any of you are interested, either tonight or Thursday night, tonight from 8 to 10 or Thursday from 9 to 10, in coming into Second Life and having us play your podcast and discussing your podcast with people who are in there. It would really be wonderful. So let me know if you would be interested in doing that.
I also wanted to offer help to everyone here and anyone in the extension course, help with video. If anyone's interested in doing a video, we have equipment that you guys can use here. Like I say, if you've got a camera, you can do it at home. And if you have any problems or questions, feel free to email me, dean@pculture.org. So,
and I wanted to say that these podcasts that you've already done, I encourage you to treat them as works in progress, mix and remix, redo, whatever you can do to improve. And I would love to encourage you to comment on other podcasts. And so I want to make a specific suggestion to you. Not required, but on the blog post, it's perfectly possible to add a comment. And just as a way of organizing, if you're willing to, like, look at four of them, look at the two above yours and the two below yours and see if you can be willing to comment. The comments at this point, when all of you are thinking about what you want to do and how you might want to do it, would come at the best time for you to incorporate comment into your thought process. And so I just would encourage you to go for it if you would. So thank you, Dean, very much for coming today. It was just wonderful. All right, class dismissed.